we hit scale really quickly through the pandemic. Just to give you some context, in 2020, in 8 months, we grew from zero to $800,000 in revenue. And then from 2021, we went from $800,000 to nearly $6 million. So it was like 600% growth. Everything was like really exploding in so many different ways. And we continue to grow in 2022, which is also pretty special.
Lee Rubin is the co-founder and CEO of Confetti, a platform that empowers leaders to discover, plan, and book engaging team events. After successfully organizing in-person events, Lee knew she was ready to scale to new levels by translating her event planning workflow to virtual events. Today, Confetti is used by organizations like HubSpot, Netflix, LinkedIn, and Shopify. Coming up, the big risk that Lee took when she went all in on her business. Lee shares her tips to finding a technical co-founder. The shocking thing that happened after Confetti launched their online beta platform. And finally, you'll hear about Lee's tips for raising capital.
This is the Entrepreneurista podcast, presented by Socialfly.
It's the best business meeting you'll ever have, with must-hear real-life looks at how leading women in business are getting it done.
And what it takes to build and grow a successful company.
It's beyond the gram.
With no filters,
no limits,
and plenty of surprises.
Lee, I am so excited to finally sit down with you and hear all about your Entrepreneurista journey and story. And first, before, I have to congratulate you for winning one of our Entrepreneurista 100 awards for your business.
Aw, thank you so much. I am, first of all, so honored to be a part of this podcast, but also for winning that award. It means so much. It was really my first like significant award. And then shortly after, I was named Inc. Female Founder 200 Award. And I was like, oh my gosh, so much happening at one time. It was really beautiful surprise. So thank you so much.
Well, congrats. All good things. And when you work really hard and build businesses, a lot of great things can happen and really hard things too. So we're going to talk about all of those learning lessons today. But before we get there, Lee, did you always know growing up that you wanted to start your own business one day?
Yeah, it's pretty weird, but apparently, since I was six, I was like hustling other kids for candy. I had candy. I was hustling them for money with my candy. And I was like, my grandparents, my family always were like, okay, something's brewing here. So definitely. Wait,
I have to ask you, what candy were you hustling? I remember, I don't know, I'm going to be 39 years old. And like the big thing was like lemon heads when I was in elementary school. And we were like buying and selling lemon heads and trading stuff in elementary school. Were there like certain candies that were the thing?
I don't even remember what it was. It was probably anything that my grandma would throw in my school like lunch bag. And apparently what happened was I would come back home with money in my bag and she was like, Lee, I didn't give you this money. And I was like, I know, I sold the candies that you gave me. And I was like, by the way, can I have like a bag like next time, like a big bag, like wholesale style? And she's like, oh, okay, okay.
All right. So you had the candy business first. What happened next?
Well, I studied marketing and art in college, moved to New York City kind of on a whim, and very quickly just went into sales. I was working for, most famously, ZocDoc, if you're familiar, mm-hmm. that startup. And then I always had the itch, like really, even during college, I was like, should I start a company now? When I was like at ZocDoc, I was like, should I start a company? And eventually I was like, okay, this is what I need to be doing. And I actually saw the pain unfold in ZocDoc, where we were given a budget to put together these events. It was really difficult for us to come up with ideas, but culture was something that was really important to the organization. And we were just constantly tasked with the planning. So I saw the pain unfold in ZocDoc and I was like, maybe something's in here. Maybe there's an opportunity at hand.
What were some of the first steps that you took when you decided, all right, this is the idea, this is the pain point, and I'm going to build it into a business?
I'll say that I like kind of like locked myself in a room for a minute. I was like, are you going to do this? Are you moving forward with starting a business. But once I did, I built a Wix website. It was very lean. I didn't go and do anything crazy. And there was, I got some not great advice at the time. That was probably one of my first mistakes that I'm already coming to y'all with the mistakes that I made. But it was one of my first mistakes where as I was speaking to people and sharing with them my idea, I really wasn't afraid to talk to people about the idea. And I think that's actually a really important lesson. So many people are like, oh, I can't say it's my secret, but ideas aren't worth anything. Yeah. It's really the execution and the hard work. There's so much more beyond the idea itself that is ahead. So getting people's reaction, people being like, oh, that's cool, that's useful, and like seeing how they react. And like, you'll occasionally stumble to people that are like naysayers and like, oh, that's stupid or whatever. But the large majority of people had really positive things to say. And eventually I was like, okay, how do I do this? And I found myself some advisors and mentors in the startup world. And I started Confetti at this point, it's almost 10 years ago. So it's been a while. And we forget how long, like 10 years is quite like a lot of evolution. Yes. Like I remember the first like few iPhones were like just the, we weren't on like whatever number we're at right now, like 13. We were on like number 1, 2, 3. Yes. And I started speaking to these startup advisors and Airbnb was just becoming hot. So marketplaces were becoming a little bit more famous. And everyone's like, for marketplaces, you first need to build out your supply side. Mm-hmm. So the first like 6 months of Confetti, I just started seeking the vendors and bringing other vendors on, like painting class workshops and storytelling workshops, improv classes, all kinds of things that I thought would be fun on the marketplace. But the mistake was that our vendors were like, great, I'm on board. Now where are the customers? And I was like, oh, just be a little patient. I need to get the rest of the supply side. And, you know, 6 months later, I was like, this is tough. Like, when am I drawing the line for when I'm bringing on customers? So I shifted my focus then on customers and put like actually fake experiences on the website, like ones that I knew that I wanted to be on there, but not getting the vendor side of it first, like a balloon vendor. And then I would wait for the interest. And then after I got the interest, I started bringing on my suppliers.
So smart. Okay. And was this all in the early days still on the Wix site?
It was all on the Wix site and it was all in-person events. So that's like another thing that's like, we didn't, you know, after the pandemic, this is like a sneak peek for the listeners, but you know, we were all in person, face-to-face events, helping companies put together their events in their office most of the time.
Wow. Okay. So interesting. So was there a pivotal point in the business when you really hit scale and went to that next level?
It really depends on what you're referring to as scale, but I really consider the majority of the scale that happened after the pandemic. So I'll give you just like a quick overview of kind of my career journey within Confetti. I made the first 6 months, as I said, running after the supply side. And then the next few months was me learning about the business, right? I was actually in front of customers, starting to plan events, figuring out how to acquire more. And then at a certain point, I had enough conviction that I was like, okay, there's something substantial here that I think is worth bringing to the next level. Got more bad advice. The debate at the time was, do you bring a website developer, like someone who you can, like an employee, a VP of engineering, like, but someone like that, or do you go with like a founder and equity? And like, people would tell me like, equity is your most expensive resource. You don't want to give that away. So I literally poured my life savings in a contractor in Canada that I never had met, and started building the product with him. And we were building a product together for about a year until I realized, I'm like, this isn't going anywhere. I don't know what this website hasn't launched. The Wix website is doing so much better. And I finally made peace that I needed a co-founder. So I moved back to Israel, which is where I was born. There's a very vibrant tech talent in Israel. And I went on a hunt for a technical co-founder, and that took me about a year and a half. Him and I worked together for about a year on the product. And eventually he was like, Lee, you got to go back to the United States to raise us some capital. Like, we can't just keep living paycheck to paycheck. Went back to New York City. Took me about a year to raise our seed round, you know, more or less settling back in. and building a new network and then and raising the seed. And we raised our seed round in August of 2019. We launched our really amazing beta in January of 2020. And then a few short months later, COVID hit and we totally needed to pivot. And it was just a wild experience. So we hit scale really quickly through the pandemic. Just to give you some context, in 2020, in 8 months, we grew from zero to $800,000 in revenue. And then from 2021, we went from $800,000 to nearly $6 million. So it was like 600% growth. Everything was like really exploding in so many different ways. And we continue to grow in 2022, which is also pretty special.
Such an incredible story. And I have so many questions for you based on everything that you just shared. So thank you so much for that context and background. And it's, you know, so interesting, just all of the twists and turns and where everything took you and you stayed focused on this goal of building this company. But as things change, it just sounds like you pivoted and figured out, you know, what do we have to do now based on circumstances and what's happening? And you didn't give up even when you had the bad developer from Canada that you spent your life savings on.
Totally. Yeah. It's been such a journey. And I felt like the journey only almost to some extent began once we were hitting scale. But I knew that before then there was like 6 years of work that was really hard and the bootstrapping and, you know, just like not getting, applying to these wonderful programs and not getting any like, you know, sorry, we did not accept you or whatever else. There was like 6 years of that. And then the fate kind of changed. And, you know, everybody thought we were going to like die from COVID. Like, that's probably not the right word to use. I'll be whatever you wrote that. But, you know, everybody was like, oh, Lee, so sorry. Like your events company doesn't have a place right now in this new reality. And everyone thought, like, was telling me, like, we're so sorry. We know you just worked so hard on raising capital and that you can't fulfill your vision. But we just pivoted super quickly.
Were you scared in those moments, like when COVID first started and you had just raised this round, the whole business model you had developed was based on in-person events? Like, did you have any virtual events? Like, were you doing any of that type of event business at all?
Nothing. Yeah, it was, when I look back at it, it's pretty unique because I don't remember having any fear. I was weirdly calm and I really love building a business from scratch, like that 0 to 10, 20%. I think if you're an entrepreneur, you have a thrill for that big, especially if you're a serial entrepreneur, you have like a thrill for that beginning, like those early days. So I was like, oh, it's kind of fun. I get to build a new like business almost from scratch. So I don't know. I really weirdly enjoyed it. I worked crazy hours the first like 2.5 months before my parents, like I was living with my parents during COVID in the beginning. I was like a single woman and they were like, you can't live in New York City right now on your own, Lee. We know that you love it there, but like come back home. And I worked like crazy, but it was a really unique period in my life. It was pretty interesting because when COVID broke out, we're an events company. There's face-to-face, this human connection that all of a sudden can't be done. You know, our investors that just gave money to us was like, what do we do? My friends, my family were like, Lee, we're so sorry. You worked so hard on raising this capital. And now what are you going to do? Like, how are you going to be able to make it through this new reality? And it was so interesting for us as a company to transition ourselves to this new virtual world that ended up being our biggest breakthrough. So I'm actually, you know, I'm glad that we took this really difficult opportunity and made it into something that ended up being something positive for us.
Yeah, so interesting. Okay, so I want to go back and hear about some of the learning lessons from hiring that initial developer in Canada. What are the learning lessons that you would share with someone that's thinking about, you know, launching a new business, starting an app? Maybe someone may already have a website and they want to hire an app developer. Like, what should people be thinking about before they hand over their life savings?
So as for like tips, tricks, people who are getting started, I think that first you really need to listen to your market. Like I knew that what I was doing was valid because I was speaking to customers and I was actually getting them to pay me for it. So that's actually one thing that if you can get a dollar from your customers, and you know, dollar metaphorically, but ideally more than a dollar for whatever product or service that you have, you'll know that you'll be onto something. And my other tip for that is if you feel confident in your ability to work on something that's a bit more technological, then that's great. Like if you've worked for a tech startup before, if you worked with R&D before, you've worked with product before, and you have confidence in your ability to lead that part of the business, then amazing. But if you don't, then bring a partner, a leader, someone who has like real stakes within the company and can help make sure that you're moving into the right direction. And once I had my co-founder, Eyal, it was a game changer for us. We started building the product and the platform, and the company started really moving to the right direction. Whereas the product that I was creating with this contractor, it's nice, maybe like kind of historical memorabilia, but other than that, it was just a waste of time, money, everything.
Expensive learning lesson, but helpful for everyone else listening. So thank you, Lee, for all you went through.
Totally.
Up next, Lee's best tips to prepare for your seed round. Lee, can you share, you know, when you decided, okay, I need to go find a co-founder, you move back to Israel, you start searching for a year to find the right person, and then you find the right person and you now have to structure an agreement. Can you talk to me about how you manage that process and how did you figure out, how do you structure an equity agreement with a co-founder who may not be the original co-founder? Any advice you can share there?
Yeah, really good question. So there's different schools of thought here. So I will say that I'll take a step back just to say, like, I'm the kind of person that there's no like right or wrong answers. Everybody is very individualistic. And it really depends on the nature of your relationship. The majority of the schools of thought will say, no matter who came up with the idea, as soon as you're bringing on a co-founder, it really needs to be a 50-50 split. But it depends on the partnership. Like, you know, I'm really grateful that my partner came in. He realized that I was coming in, first of all, with an investment in the business. I had already saved money. I wrote a check back into the organization. He was able to start with a salary. And that allowed us to be able to agree on a slightly different equity ownership. He's still a very much a majority player. And it was very important for me and for him to feel like we are equals. Obviously, in the way that we felt aligned well with us. And I'm grateful just in general, we're very like no ego kinds of people who hopefully, you know, whoever is listening, that you find co-founders that very low ego and just like are there to do the right thing for the business and that both of you are looking after each other's well-being and success. But if you're very early onto the journey, like very early, then 50-50 is probably the right bet to go.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. Super helpful to hear. How do you divide and conquer in the business and, you know, figure out your different roles and responsibilities? And has that changed over time since growing the business?
Yeah. And actually, one other thing I was just going to mention all of a sudden that I remembered from the last point is make sure that there's a cliff, a one-year cliff. Make sure that there's a four-year vesting period at least. Be expected that if you are to raise capital, you'll renew/revest all your shares again, start from zero or near zero. Like all of these things are normal. But that cliff is really helpful because you got a year to figure out, you know, your relationships together. And it's going to be the most important relationship that you have, which transitions us to this new question. And I think, again, like we looked at each other's strengths. So like, it was very clear. Yeah, obviously we brought him on as CTO, but he's so much more than a CTO. And like, for example, interestingly enough, even though English is his second language, it's mine too, but I'm definitely more American and more fluent in English. I'm supposed to be. He is just amazing at legal stuff. And his significant other is a lawyer. His siblings come from law. And like, he honestly should have been a lawyer. He's like, he's so great. When we're arguing, it's like, you know, he's got the facts all bulleted out. He's got like, I've I'm like, wow, I'm so like more feeling and emotional based. I'm like, I don't remember what you said. I don't remember when it was. So not the best lawyer over here. But he's a great like lawyer in that stance. And for finance, both of us didn't like finance, but it was kind of the division of, okay, he's taking the legal side. I'm going to take the financial side. And I learned to find ways to fall in love with the finance portion. And now I actually really love creating business plans. I like getting my hands into the nitty gritty of the finances. And so I think it's just a mixture of strengths, knowing where one person is busy, to not have any ego, not to be like, you know, we're always just there for each other. We're always at capacity. But if one person's like, I can't do this, can you do this? We say yes. And it really feels like a perfect partnership. And I often like to compare, I'm not married, I don't have kids, but I've always felt like if there was like a healthy marriage and a true division task when it comes to childcare as much as possible, there's probably a lot of similarities.
Yes. I would say a business partnership is definitely like a marriage. You need really great communication. You need to be able to trust each other. Those are, I would say, the two most important things in any relationship in general, actually, but definitely very important in a business partnership, because if you don't have that most trust and respect and the same vision as your partner, definitely won't get too far.
Totally. Yeah.
How did you find your business partner, and any recommendations you can share for founders that want to start a business, they don't have a technical background, and they're looking to find that technical co-founder?
So I was going to say there's all kinds of different co-founders out there, ones that are a bit more operational, ones that are incredible capital raisers, ones that are technical. So first of all, it's assessing again your strengths, your weaknesses, what does the business need? Maybe not everybody who's listening wants to build a tech company, which, by the way, like, totally okay. Not everything should be a tech company. Not everything needs to be with a venture capital. And I have a lot to say about that. But in my case, I wanted to build a tech company. I knew that I needed to find a technical co-founder. And I interviewed over 100 people to get to that. It was my most serious interview to date, because this person that I'm getting married with, yes. Like, right. And like, I needed to be right. And having all those data points with all the other interviews allowed me to better understand more and more what I was looking for. So for example, you know, naturally with engineers, many of them, their strengths isn't within communication. And so it was very clear to me that after speaking to so many people, I was like, I really need someone with strong communication skills. And that was like, it was non-negotiable.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. It was my non-negotiable. I need someone with really good communication. I don't care how amazing of an engineer they are. I need them to be good in communicating. I brought on a technical advisor. His name is Itamar. And I'm so grateful for him, because I knew that I could maybe grade someone based off of our chemistry, our vibe, but I couldn't grade them on the technical element. So having this person who's really been there and done that, review the resumes, review the assignment with the code reviews that we did, gave me the confidence that Eyal had the technical portion, and that our time together that we spent for days, we spent a lot of, you know, hours together working on a small project. As a side note, you know, we did a small pilot together where we had like 2 weeks of being like, okay, you know, if we want to give this a shot, let's do a mini project and see how that comes to play, which I can share the story of that. But all of this gave us the feeling like at the end of those 2 weeks, it was fun to work together. We saw an outcome that was money, like already generated money. And we were like, all right, we feel good about moving forward.
I love that. I remember years ago, I don't think it exists anymore. And I'm trying to remember, I can't even remember the name of the site, but like there was in New York, there was a site for people who were looking for co-founders to meet other co-founders. Do you know of any of, like, I don't even know of any of those sites anymore. And as you were telling me the story and describing the experience, I'm like, oh my gosh, this would be such an interesting like podcast or TV show, like interview, like finding the next best co-founder, like interviewing people to find the co-founder. I feel like it's a podcast or TV show. So
totally. There's so many matchmaking on Netflix. Maybe there's now a startup matchmaking. maybe you're onto something on here. So I can tell you, again, it's within Israel, which is also like a little bit of a sensitive subject, but within the military unit of Israel, within Israel's military unit, there's a program called 8200. It's their technical unit. It's their most elite unit for all engineers. So I got connected to the person who's responsible for the alumni of that group. And I said, please, I'm a female entrepreneur. I would really appreciate if you could blast to this network this job description of, you know, who it is that I'm looking for and like the traction of the business. And from that, I got like dozens of applicants. I did go to meetups and all that fun stuff. And I know that there are meetups in New York, but I just didn't live there at the time. So it's I don't know if I have anything helpful on that front.
Coming up, you'll hear all about Lee's unique strategy for investor meetings. I want to talk about the process of raising capital. I know you shared when you came back to New York, you both realized like now was the time you needed to raise capital to really build everything. How did you determine how much capital you needed to raise? And walk me through your fundraising journey and story. And I can't wait to hear all of the learning lessons because I know it is not an easy process. And I think you said it took about a year to close the round, right?
Yeah. First of all, getting the materials prepped, I think it's really important that before you go and raise, before you start, you know, wasting people's times with meetings and connections, make sure you find what that checklist is, the business plan, everything, to really have those T's crossed and I's dotted. Because once you're out raising, people are going to be like, great, send me this, send me that. And you don't want to be like, great, let me just wait a month until I've figured out this business plan. But, you know, I really appreciated the process of creating a business plan. But, you know, most startups or like most VCs have certain metrics that they're looking for in order for you to raise the Series A. So you have to reverse engineer that plan. And you need to be like, okay, like the classic amount of money, at least back in the day, I don't know what it is today, to raise your Series A was like $1 million in monthly recurring revenue or whatever that number is. We're not SaaS, so I might be butchering the numbers. But speak to VCs, get to understand what it is that they're looking for to raise that Series A and reverse engineer a plan and say, okay, this is our product. This is how this is the assumption of the pricing that we're going to have. This is the average churn that we're seeing or expecting. How many salespeople do I need? How many marketing people do we need? What's the funnel currently for acquiring customers? Like you do need to have already some, at least in this market and economy, you need to already have some traction to get a check from an investor. But at least back in the day, if you can sell on a dream, definitely that's great and you can do that. But they're still going to want to see a business plan and it could be like, this is our assumptions for things. And you can use industry metrics, speak to people, define what those metrics are so it's related to your industry and be able to use that in your pitch. But you need to be able to have that. Once you have that in your business plan, there's going to be a number that it's tied into and you'll be able to see if it's reasonable or not reasonable. But like, in my opinion, you know, you can raise like a friends and family round. You can raise like a safe for a couple $100,000, but don't go into your seed, in my opinion, raising less than like $1.5-2 million. Like you should be able to do something pretty significant. And the couple $100,000, oh my gosh, they go by so quickly. Mm-hmm. And you want to be able to prove yourself. So that's another little tip in there.
Any other tips you can share about just the pitching process, being in front of investors and things that they're looking for and what worked well for you?
Yeah. So one thing that I'll say is that the secret sauce to fundraising, the number one thing that you need to figure out is confidence. Everything else that people will say is like noise and like everybody else has their own thing. And I remember like latching on to so many advice that I was like, you know, some people would be like, oh, you should do like FOMO and you should pretend all these things. And I'm like, oh, it doesn't feel like that's me. And so I had to find my own voice and I need to be really confident about that. I mean, as a female entrepreneur, I also think that we get we get really, like, investors get really into the nitty gritty of all the numbers. You have to have an answer to every question. You need to be prepared for everything and come out of every single conversation with an investor understanding which questions did they ask and how do I perfect it a little bit better over time and kind of memorize and re-script those answers. But confidence, 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 the number one thing that's going to get somebody to write you a check. I think another thing that was a very big learning lesson to me, you're not fundraising really if until you're doing about 4 to 6 meetings a day. Everything before that is just like you pretending kind of that you're fundraising, but you know that you're fundraising when you're doing a lot of meetings within the day and that it's going to be sprints of a handful of weeks, which is why a lot of people will recommend to time and be like, hey, great, you know, I'm starting to plan a fundraise. I'm going to start in August, whatever that month out of the year is. So glad we got this opportunity to connect. What are you looking to see in a company in order for you to write a check? Try to get that information. Great. I'll keep you posted once we're fundraising. You put together your materials, you have those meetings lined up, and you have those multiple meetings a day. There's other schools of thought, by the way. For example, you might want to have a few different batches and you want to start with your least favorite investors. So I'm whispering that. Maybe you rank them as like A, B, and C, and you start with the C's because you want to practice. Those are the people that maybe you don't actually want to get their money or you don't think that they'll give you the money, but you want to see how the pitch comes out of your mouth. You want to feel more confidence. You take a break for 2 weeks to get back into, you know, fixing and perfecting that pitch. And then you go back into pitching with the tier B's. And then you go at the end, hopefully the tier B's start to gain traction where they're like, cool, I'm interested. I, you know, maybe even a term sheet. And you want to ideally get to the point, this is so much easier said than done. And I will say that it's never happened to me. This is like the way that I've always tried to make it happen this way. It's just never happened this way. But now I'm going into Series B. I'm like, okay, now I know one more thing of how I can make it happen this way. But ideally, you want to try to get it to time that you'll get a term sheet right when you're starting to pitch your tier A investors. And once you go in there, you can be like, look, to be honest, we have a term sheet but I really like you. I've been following you. I've been reading your blog posts. You know, I've kept in touch with you. I've given you the updates. And I really want the opportunity to go through this process with you and give you an opportunity to be a part of this journey as well. But again, only if it feels comfortable coming out of your mouth and if you feel confident while you're saying it.
I love that you just said that, for giving the investor the opportunity to be part of it, because I think that whole reframe is what founders need to hear. Like, when an investor invests in your business, you're giving them an opportunity to invest in this incredible business that you are building. And it's not for everyone, but you're giving them that opportunity. And I think thinking of it that way is so important for founders that have that mindset.
Totally. I think, you know, another thing that's so important for people who are early on in their journey is it's so hard to come out of these VC meetings. And each time you're sometimes pitching dozens of VCs and investors and you're getting no after no. And at a certain point, you're like, is it me? Is it the company? And you need to realize that there's so many other things that I think are worthwhile, like knowing. For example, you should really know what stage a VC invests. Mm-hmm. So like, I always used to like, this is so naive and naive of me to think about it, but I would speak to investors and be like, we write minimum checks of like $100 to $20 million. From $10 to $20 million. And then I'd be like, oh, then piece of cake. You're going to find it so easy to give me a $1 million check. That's all I need. And like, no, it doesn't work that way. I'm not in their stage.
Yeah.
So it's things like that. It's things that ask them if they have an active fund, if they have any money left in their fund, how much money is left in their fund? Because investors also raise money and they have a pot of cash that they can use. And they might be at the end of that pot of cash. They might be at zero. They might be raising a new fund. So that no might not be a no that's a reflection of you. It might be a reflection of the industry that they're focused on. It might be on, you know, them not having any money to give you to begin with.
Do you ask a lot of these questions to the investor upfront in that first meeting? I know you probably try to learn as much as you can about them before even going in. But some of the questions, like, you actually have to ask them to know. Do you go in asking those questions or wait till the end? What's been a strategy that's worked?
Yeah. So I personally like to start meetings, passing the mic over to them, saying, I'd really love for you to introduce your firm, and giving them the opportunity to talk. I then interject with a few questions, and it could be those questions. Absolutely. So one thing that I like to ask is, like, what are the growth metrics that you're looking for when you're writing a check? Or what kind of investments are you actively looking for? And you'll hear them be like, cybersecurity. And I'll be like, great, I know that I'm not in cybersecurity. Or like, they'll be like, Bitcoin or AI or whatever they're going to say. So you start to gauge an understanding of, like, where they're at. Super normal that VCs are like, oh, we invest in everything, we're generalists. Like, also common, but you're starting to gain data points. And then at a certain point, you do want to obviously leave time for you to speak about yourself, because that's what's going to get them excited to have that second meeting. So I think that that's great. I also think that depending on how much leverage you have, it's okay to ask some questions via email, say, hey, super excited to get something on the books. Few quick questions for you that I would love if you could answer before meeting. And you know, you ask a few of those. I don't remember mine off the top of my head that I used to ask, but it really is like, you have to go into a phase when you're fundraising. You need to have all your notes. Like, it has to be very organized. And it's like, you're either fundraising or you're operating the business. And they're two totally different things.
Do you have a CRM or tools that you use that helped you stay organized during your fundraise?
I didn't. Well, I mean, I had like a Notion document, and I think Notion was good for me at the time. I think going into the Series B, I might consider some of the new fresh tools that exist, but some of them are like thousands of dollars. It's definitely not, like, if you're in the early stages, it's not worth, I think, for anyone to spend thousands of dollars. It is worth it for you to stay organized. Every snippet that you have that you're writing, save those little snippets of email so you don't have to rewrite the same email over and over. And as you're making edits to that snippet, you want to make it directly onto that knowledge hub that you have on Notion or Google Docs or wherever else you have that information. But you don't really need anything super fancy. I also, there's like a lot of questions about, you know, do you put investors through those like PDFs that they have to like use like a password, and then you can track how many times they see it. But investors have caught on to that. And so they just download the presentation right away. And I don't like any of that stuff. It comes back to dating again. Like, you don't like dating the guy or girl that plays games on you. You want to build like a real relationship. Yeah. And we understand that maybe games are part of it, but you need to be real with the people. And like, what does it mean if someone reviewed my presentation 10 times? Does that mean that are they going to write a check? Do I know if they're going to? No, I'm not going to know if they're going to write a check write a check.
Something I will share with you. So we use DocSend, and I love DocSend. And actually with Entreprenista, we have a code for our Entreprenistas with DocSend because it can be expensive, but we have a code to make it a lot less expensive for founders that are starting and fundraising. But what I like about DocSend is that you can actually see the pages investors are on, or even like in new business pitches, you can see where they're spending their time and what's important to them. So then when you're going into a meeting, you're like, oh, they spent 5 minutes on the slide about, you know, the growth or our team. Like, you can kind of gauge what might be important to them and ask questions or lean into that in the conversation. So that is something I do like.
Teach their own style. That's the beauty of it, right? I'm like, find the thing
that's the thing. Everyone like needs to do it their own way and what works best for them, but so helpful. Like, all of the advice and tips that you just shared, like based on your experience, that's so helpful to hear, because you didn't know all of these things when you first started. You've learned them now, and now you're going to take all of your learnings that you've already, you know, successfully raised, and now going into your next round, now you have this whole toolkit of what's worked and what didn't work. And it's so helpful. So thank you for sharing all of that. Before we wrap up, I do want to jump in and talk about your actual business, because it solves such a need for so many business owners that are trying to figure out how the heck do we keep our team motivated and together and team building and all of these things that were definitely easier to do in person. And sometimes over Zoom, things can just feel like awkward with the team sometimes, and you don't know what to do, and you're busy running a business and trying to plan all these events. It's really hard. And you've created a whole business, a successful business, to solve that. So can you tell me more about the platform and who your customers are, who might be interested in it? I want to hear all the details.
Absolutely. Well, I realize I always like when podcasts, I'm like, I want to give as much value as possible. I totally forget to even like explain who I am and what I'm doing. Essentially, Confetti is a platform that now 6,000 companies use to put together their team building events. As you heard from the story, we used to be in person, but now we are 100% virtual. No immediate intention to go back to the in-person world, but we're obviously primarily helping distributed or remote first teams. And our buyer persona is often what we call culture contributors, people in HR, executive assistants. But interestingly enough, in the large organizations that we support, like Google and Facebook and Shopify, Spotify, Pinterest, Etsy, that are all customers of ours, the responsibility often falls on the team lead's shoulders, because the HR team just can't do it all anymore. And they're like, hey, you know, we'll give you the budget, but you're going to need to plan this on your own. So we really help people across the organization. And I like to say that there's three layers of culture. There's your team culture, you have your departmental culture, and you have your company-wide culture. And a company needs to invest in each one of those departments, just like a family. You have you and your significant other, and that's one culture. You have you and your kids, that's another culture as a family. When the grandparents are in town, that's a whole other culture. And it's really, each one is very individual, and you got to invest in all of them. And we have really incredible experiences on Confetti collections that range from just pure fun escape rooms that are virtual escape rooms, like really fun murder mystery parties, different kinds of trivia or charity games, to diversity, equity, and inclusion, professional development. Everything's really grounded on memorable experiences and getting your team to feel something and building a layer of empathy with one another that gets them to just like who they're working with a little bit more, because so many of us just hate Mondays. And it's just a sad story that I wanted to change as you know, I put my impact on this world.
I'm on your site right now, so I'm looking at everything live as you're sharing this. And I have to be sure that Joanne and our team knows about what you offer, because she's always planning everything and planning these virtual events. And it looks like you can just literally do everything with a click of a button and save everyone a lot of time. So I am so excited to explore everything for our team. This is truly incredible. I have a question for you. So with, please, I see on your site, there's different like virtual team buildings. Is there always like a person behind these, or are some of these, everything's just automated?
Yes, all of our events have a live host. And okay, I want to say all of our events come with a happiness commitment. Literally, if the team doesn't have a good time, we will give you your money back, which is like risk-free. We're here and committed to making sure that everyone enjoys themselves. But yeah, it all comes with a live host. And what's not obvious about our business model is we actually own the intellectual property of our marketplace for the majority of our experiences. So we work with experts, we create a curriculum, we create what we think is the most perfect game. And then we have a marketplace of facilitators and hosts that learn that curriculum. We only work with corporates. I mean, I say that our focus is on corporates. You could do something if you were like a birthday party or whatever, but that's not where we're focused at. And yeah, I mean, it just means that you know, there's no middleman fees, there's no booking fees. You can plan one event with us. We have packages and discounts if you want to like up the relationship with us and save more money. But you got a few different ways.
All right, this is amazing. Definitely, you definitely have a new customer right here. So thank you, Lee, for sharing all of that. Can you tell me, how did you form these partnerships or get customers as large as Google and Spotify and Shopify? Because those are big companies that can be very hard to break into and find the right decision maker there to then start using your product. How did you get to these big companies? And any tips you can share for our entrepreneurs who are trying to land these big partners and clients?
I wish I had more helpful news on this one, but something that's also very unique for Confetti is that we've had a 100% inbound approach. So we don't have a sales team. All those companies came to us. And I think in our specific, you know, unique case, we have a very friendly website and we market the website just like we would, you know, on Uber or Airbnb. Mm-hmm. We're kind of more B2C in nature. But once that customer is in our door, we start acting like B2B. But so yeah, all those companies, we got very fortunate of them coming to us. But I think we gave them a really great experience that people talk about events. They're viral by nature. There's very high word of mouth. And then, you know, one colleague tells the next, you tell your husband or your husband sees it, you on a Zoom screen laughing and they're like, oh, I need a team building event. So that's kind of just what happens. There's also, once you're in a team, another team like starts recommending it. So that's really kind of been our approach. I will say though, for B2B, outbound emails is just one of, like, in the early days of Confetti, I did a little bit of outbound emails. I would also go to conferences. I'd meet people face to face. That's a great way to kind of get your foot in the door, just making sure that, you know, people see you and they're like, hey, I like hanging out with you. What did you do? Or like, and then you're like, hey, I would love your feedback on our platform. And then they just, you know, one thing evolves into the next. And before you know, who knows, maybe you're making $10-50 million a year.
I love it. No, thank you for sharing that. What would you say is the craziest thing that's happened to you or you've experienced since starting your business?
I think the pandemic was really that kind of craziest thing where I wasn't expecting. I mean, no one was, but you know, it's just something that I could have never have prepared for. I know that I know we've talked about already, but it really is a big deal for an event company to be like, what? Like, who would have thought?
I know. Well, you did it, and it's so incredible all you've done. What are you most proud of that you've accomplished in starting your business?
Well, I hopefully it's not a cop out, but obviously, you know, getting the reward from y'all was such a huge honor, and I'm really, really grateful to be a part of the community. But another thing is, like, I really feel like I have the honor to work alongside my team. Our revenues is just such a big indicator of like the accomplishments and the success and the aggregation of all of our talents coming and manifesting. Having them give me the opportunity and all of us to just grow alongside one another. And you know, I've definitely made a lot of mistakes on that front, but I just feel like every day working with them and us regrouping together and brainstorming how do we take this company again to the next level is just a big honor and an accomplishment that I'm just so grateful for every single day.
Well, you should be so proud of all you accomplished. It's truly, truly incredible. And yes, there's nothing better than working alongside of a team that's passionate and has the same vision and mission as you. So congrats again on everything that you have accomplished. My final question for you, Lee, and I feel like we could talk forever and ever and ever, and I'm so glad to learn that we live close to each other. So hopefully we'll meet in person soon. But what does being an entrepreneurista mean to you?
I think it's challenging myself to the fullest extent of my dreams and not leaving planet Earth with any kind of wish I coulda. Mm-hmm. Just really trying to manifest those dreams and not being afraid of the no's and just going for it is, I think, what it means to me.
I love it. Well, you are definitely a true entrepreneurista. Lee, where can everyone find you, follow you? And for business owners or team leaders that might be interested in using the platform, where should they head over to?
Absolutely. So first of all, you can follow me on LinkedIn. I believe it's like Ruben L is the like underscore, but you can find me at Lee Ruben, LeeRubin. I also have very much an open door policy with anybody that reaches out. I might be a little bit slow with all of the emails that I have to crunch through, like hundreds, if not thousands per week. But lee.rubin@withconfetti.com. Love to support any of the listeners in whichever way I can. Although I also know that y'all are in such great hands with your team. And so, yes, I'm open door policy.
Well, thank you, Lee. And we will be linking out to all of the links that Lee just shared in the show notes below. So head over to the show notes right now and you can go find Lee and head over to her website as well. Lee, thank you again for being here. I'm Stephanie, and this is the best business meeting I've ever had. Hey, thanks for listening and leaving us a 5-star review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'd love to stay in touch with each of you. You can listen to all of our latest episodes at entreprenista.com and connect with us on Instagram at entreprenistas. We'd also love to invite you to join the Entreprenista League, our private membership community for trailblazing women. You can head over to entreprenista.com/the-league. We'll see you there. Wishing you a productive week ahead.